Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. Jacob Rees-Mogg needs no introduction to the public. One of his greatest strengths is that he is, in the slightly aged IT acronym, Holy WYSIWYG. What you see is what you get. You either do or don't like his conservative politics. You either do or don't like his cultural eccentricity. But perhaps for our purposes, what is of most interest is that he is one of the very few Catholics surviving and even flourishing in the public square, despite being known to be a passionate and sincere Christian. In fact, reversing the thrust of social history, he's made a virtue out of being a Catholic. When Tim Farron of the Liberal Democrats was lethally ambushed for having Christian and traditional views on marriage, a universal norm up to only 10 years ago, his career was destroyed by journalists accusing him of voluntarily believing in such repressive dogmas when so many liberal Protestants had long before abandoned the teaching of the Bible and the Church Fathers. Kate Forbes did a little but not much better in the face of the exclusive, inclusive, pseudo-liberal secular onslaught on her We Free Christian beliefs. But Jacob Rees-Mogg has developed a cast-iron defence in his propagation and defence of Christian morals. He fixes his interviewer with a steely and uncompromising gaze and says, "These are the beliefs of the Catholic Church, and I am a faithful Catholic." In other words, if you don't like this stuff, you'll get nowhere by attacking me. It's what all Catholics everywhere believe, so unless you want to declare yourself a Catholophobe, move on. And they do. He is therefore able to say in public debate, "The Catholic Church's teachings are authoritative, there is a moral absolute on abortion, that is wrong." And he gets away with it, because it's a teaching of the Catholic Church, to which he is being faithful. And he's wholly unafraid to go against the herd on matters of principle. He has said of his faith, "If you're doing something different, you need to have a confidence that it's important." Of lesser moral importance, though obviously correct in the minds of all right-thinking people, is his stated ethical and nutritional conviction that unsalted butter is a sin against the Holy Ghost. Jacob Rees-Mogg joins me now.
Jacob, I wanted to start by, first of all, thank you very much for joining us today. It's very nice to have a conversation with you, and I've been looking forward to this for some time. I really wanted to begin by talking more personally about you and the Catholic faith. Your family's been Catholic for some time. Were they always Catholic? What kind of religious, spiritual background did the family have that brought you to where you are now?
Well, it comes from my grandmother, my father's mother. So I can't say we're in a long line of recusants. We're not. My grandmother was Irish-American, and all four of her grandparents left Ireland in the middle of the 19th century. And so the Catholicism came from her. And then actually my grandfather, mother, and wife are all Anglicans, but the Catholic Church always takes everybody on board. So my father was brought up as Catholic, and we were too. And so that's how Catholicism came into the family.
You're very much an establishment figure, psychologically, politically, socially, obviously. Haven't you felt any temptation to adopt Anglicanism simply as a cousinly faith, pragmatically, so much more at the heart of the establishment? I mean, you may not come from a long line of recusants, but nonetheless, being a Catholic sets you somewhat at odds to the establishment system, the reflexes, the checks and balances, the preferences. Have you not been tempted to become more pragmatic about your Christian faith?
Well, I'm afraid it's a matter of truth. And if the Catholic Church is the repository of truth, and if St. Peter was given the instruction to be the rock on which the Church was founded, and that descends to the Holy Father, then that is where truth lies. And that is more important than the establishment, which I quite like not being a full member of. The establishment is not always to the good of the United Kingdom, that actually you need some grit in the oyster. I admire the Anglican Church in many ways. I think it's a good thing that we have an established church, but I'm very glad it's not the Catholic Church, because if you're part of the establishment, you have to go along with the politesse of the establishment. You can't really challenge it. And I think this is difficult for the Anglican Church in standing up for the traditional teachings of Christianity, because they're not very fashionable at the moment. And it's been a problem actually all the way back to Elizabeth I that the political element of the Anglican Church, the compromise of the settlement, has caused it problems. And I know you'll remember that Cormac Murphy O'Connor, late Cardinal, was thought likely to go into the House of Lords. And it was a thoroughly good thing that he didn't, because if the Catholic Church becomes part of the English establishment, then it would be much harder for it to stand up for its fundamental beliefs with rigour.
I think that's true, and it's much more an advantage than perhaps many Catholics think, although there seems to be a sense of detachment in the Catholic community from the political centre of what it is to be an Englishman, so or an English citizen. I mean, having been an Anglican the whole of my life and part of the establishment and simply taking it for granted in the rather lackadaisical, you didn't describe it like that, but there's a sort of relaxed over-identification between Anglicanism and the secular state. It's been a great surprise to me to become a Catholic, to see quite how different the culture is. I mean, you describe it as usefully detached, and I think that's right, and I hope that will act as a platform to provide some critique, which we might talk about later on in the conversation, about this present secular situation. But there also seems to me to be a sense of disablement in the Catholic community, that we're so much not part of the establishment, and perhaps with overtones of being the religion of immigrants and outsiders, that there's almost, well, this isn't our fight, this isn't our responsibility, let's let other people get on with managing the tension between Christian values and secular political pragmatism.
Yes, I see that. And I think we should do what we can to support the Anglican Church in its very difficult role. It may surprise you to know, I'm actually a great admirer of the Archbishop of Canterbury. I think he is a very good and holy man who has one of the most difficult jobs imaginable, that he has to try within the confines of the English establishment and within the confines of the differing views of the Anglican Communion to give authority and leadership to a body that doesn't give him the power to do it. And that is an incredibly difficult job. And I think he deserves support and prayer from Catholics in that difficult role.
I think it's a completely impossible job, but isn't it? It's even worse than you described, though. It's not just that he doesn't have the levers of power. Again, a lot of people make the mistake of thinking the Anglican Church is the equivalent of the Catholic Church in the way it looks and sounds as though it's set up in the same way, but power is devolved, subsidiarity rules in Anglicanism, as you'll know only too well. But there's no magisterium, there's no common belief about what Anglicanism stands for. And at the moment, that must make it, well, it would make it very difficult if it wasn't for the fact that the Anglican establishment seems to be compensating for that by simply mimicking secular standards, not even entering into a debate or trying perhaps to build a bridge between a more robust ethical critique the Catholic Church offers and the way in which secular society is moving very quickly in an anti-Christian direction. I'm glad you respect Archbishop Welby. I don't want to lure you into being rude, but it's not just a difficult situation. It's almost impossible in the absence of any common belief in the ethical responsibilities that Anglicanism ought to embody.
It is difficult because the founding principles of the Anglican Church, the 39 Articles, and it's very hard to find anybody who believes in all 39 of the 39 Articles. And that is by law established, the belief of the Anglican Church. Whereas the Catholic Church can always have a council of the Church, which explains, there is a continuum, obviously, in the teaching of the Catholic Church, but a new council can explain things more clearly. And the Anglican Church has an ability to do that, but it doesn't have the ability to do administrative things. Either. I had constituents of mine get in touch with me about the reorganisation of parishes in northeast Somerset. And I'm very diffident about getting involved in things that relate to the Anglican Church for obvious reasons. But I did note that our own bishop, the Bishop of Clifton, can organise and reorganise the Catholic parishes whenever he feels like it. And there is nobody to question him, and it just happens. And with a shortage of priests, this is very important because he's got a difficult job to do and he's got to balance the demands of various communities. The Anglican Church has spent years negotiating the reorganisation of parishes and still can't agree how it should be done. And the bishop can't say, this is how I'm doing it. Even in the administrative detail, the difficulty the Anglican Church has is much greater than the Catholic Church.
It's enormously problematic. I mean, I was astonished when I moved from one culture to the other. You're quite right. The poor Anglicans have to negotiate endlessly. They also have to please and entertain and be highly politically sophisticated in order to get the support of people to do the things they want to do. Without whose support, they couldn't do it because it's a combined venture. Whereas, as you quite rightly say, at least episcopally in Catholic terms, a bishop has power to do what he wants, both with the clergy and with the parishes, which means if they want to achieve something, they can. But the poor Anglican church has to move immensely slowly, and very much of the time can't even manage it. Or if it manages it, creates a lot of resentment by moving slowly but surely the rights of parish priests to have tenure in their own parishes and be protected from the bishop, because the pragmatic requirements of management make that happen. But it loses a lot of good faith. So I'm not surprised you don't want to get involved in the issues that your Anglican parishioners bring you. It'd be equally insoluble, I think.
I mean, it's more, I think, as a Catholic, that it isn't quite proper for me to get involved, rather than that it's too complicated. I mean, I think an MP can't run away from things because they're complicated, but can run away from them on a basis of propriety.
Yes, that's a very good point. I wasn't suggesting they were too difficult, and that's why
I didn't get involved.
But you're quite right. It's principle, not pragmatism, first of all. During our lifetimes, there's been a significant shift in the relationship between secular society and Christian culture. And even 10 years ago, it would have been quite impossible, I think, for me at least, to imagine the police approaching a Christian standing on a street corner and then ask the question, "What are you doing?" To which the response was, "I'm praying," and then an arrest following. So the abortion buffer zone legislation has taken a lot of people by surprise with its uncompromising vigour. But if it represents, as I think it does, this continual trajectory of anti-sympathy for Christian values, what's your own take on how that divergence between secular preferences and Christian values is growing, and what might happen in terms of the way in which Christianity, which underlines so much of our freedom in terms of free speech, democracy, the sanctity of human life, and so on, as that becomes diluted, that's going to have political implications as well. How do you see the trajectory of secular and Christian antipathy developing?
Well, first of all, from a Catholic perspective, I think we're actually in a position where it's easier to be a Catholic now than it was in my father's generation. My father was definitely not able to do things because he was a Catholic, and that hasn't happened to me in my lifetime. And so that's a change for Catholics, though not for Christianity more generally. On the specific issue, I think the extreme pro-abortionists are actually quite a small minority in this country. And I think this is why they're getting so aggressive, that they're actual promoters of abortion. They think abortion is a good thing and want to encourage people to do it. They say, "Oh, it's always terrible," but they never mean that, actually. They are advocates for abortion. If you look at opinion polling, the country at large doesn't take a Catholic view. It doesn't take my view or close to it. But it's certainly sympathetic to reducing the number of weeks at which an abortion is legal. And it's certainly concerned about abortions on the grounds of the sex of the child or women being put under pressure to have abortions by their partners. And that's where the extreme pro-abortionists, I think, are slightly panicking by measures such as trying to ban prayer and are overreaching themselves. I think most normal people in this country do not think that is right, because they're tolerant, and it's just an aggressive minority that are in favour of this type of approach. So I'm not too pessimistic about it. And the other thing to bear in mind is that the people who are in their own mind most hostile to Christianity are also by and large those who are most liberal. And they come into a confusion in the end that they preach all this liberal stuff and people must be free to believe what they like and there's equal validity and so on and so forth. And then suddenly they don't like something the Catholic Church is saying. And that is a contradiction for them, that increasing liberality means ultimately increasing tolerance. And we must remind people of that. I think that's very important. You've got to be tolerant of Christian views if your message is one of tolerance.
Well, you're quite right. And it would be very nice if the population on the whole was capable of thinking logically like that, so that when we pointed out to them that the so-called liberalism they were proclaiming had illiberal ends, they might then stop and think. But they don't seem to stop and think. And one of the problems we have is that we're in the grip of a number of groups like that. It's not just the pro-abortionists that have overreached themselves, but many of the liberal lobbies like Stonewall, which initially set up to provide aims that most liberal-minded people would have been sympathetic with broadly, even if they didn't agree with the ethics that they were providing. But they've become really very determined and illiberal to an extraordinary extent, whilst telling everybody they're still on a liberal crusade. This, I'm not asking you to respond as a member of the government. I'm asking you to respond as a detached critic of the whole system. But the government and the civil service have taken on board these illiberal liberal agencies and promoted them in a way that has had an extraordinary effect in terms of the sexualization of children in education. So in a sense, the whole sexual agenda is being driven by fairly extremist agencies, and very few people are holding them to account, including the established political agencies.
I think that's beginning to change as people realise what's been going on, and there's been some very good reporting on sex education in schools in the Daily Mail. And when parents know that this is happening, I think most parents don't approve of it and will not allow their children to be treated in this way. And you're right to be worried about this type of indoctrination. But I'm perhaps more optimistic about the general attitude of the British public at large, who haven't taken this all on board, aren't actually in favour of it. And the Catholic Church has a great strength because of its authoritative teaching. And I found that when I've got into political controversy, but have been following the teaching of the Catholic Church, the responses I get are more sympathetic than unsympathetic, because people recognise I have a right to follow the teaching of such an historic, well-established organisation. And I think it's very interesting to look at the reaction to Kate Forbes. The initial reaction was she cannot be a candidate, her campaign is over, it's all finished. And that then went very quickly, and her campaign, which was briefly thought to be impossible, even William Hague, rather shockingly William Hague, said that a person of her views couldn't be a leader of the Conservative Party, which I thought was nonsense, jumped on the bandwagon of saying what she was saying was just impossible for a modern politician. And then people reacted and said, well, no, actually, she's entitled to her view. She's not going to legislate for a theocracy. Why are you excluding We Frees from government? And so I think when the arguments get put, there is a backlash. And the same with the lady who was arrested for praying. As soon as people discovered that six policemen turned up to arrest her, when you can't normally find six policemen if there's been a burglary, everyone thought it was ridiculous. And what on earth were the police thinking about?
Well, they did. I mean, I've always enjoyed it when you've been interrogated and you've managed to cite them, unlike the leader of the Lib Dems, who said, well, these are my beliefs. And then the response was, well, if these are your beliefs, they're your personal beliefs and you aren't personally capable of standing for office. When you've said not just whether the question of whether these are my beliefs or not, but these are beliefs of the church I belong to, and therefore there's no point attacking me. You'll have to attack the whole of the Catholic Church. And then that becomes quite impossible in the context of an interview. It's been a very useful and effective way of allowing your own personal as well as in corporate integrity to resist that kind of personal demolition. But so I always thought it was probably something that only Catholics could do, because only a Catholic can say this is the teaching of my church, and therefore you don't ask me, ask the Pope, or don't ask me, ask the tradition. But I was very surprised that Kate Forbes has got away with it. I think she's the first non-Catholic to appear to have got away with saying this is not just my faith, but also the faith of the community that I belong to. And I hear you make the distinction between what the English people think, the population, in terms of their common sense support, and what the political establishment thinks. But and you're suggesting the gap between those two is narrower than I think it is. I think the gap between what common sense people in the country feel and the political classes feel is so large that actually it's not just a matter of defending Christian sensibility. There's a real sense of disenfranchisement right across the whole political process, which is bad for Christians, but bad for everybody.
The disconnect, there is definitely a disconnect between those who govern and those who are governed. Brexit was part of that. And I think a lot of the extreme gender argument is part of that. I don't think this is what is keeping awake my constituents in North East Somerset at night. I don't think they are thinking about this. I don't think it is a fundamental issue to them. And politicians have been talking about things and worrying about things and setting out guidelines for things that are irrelevant to the vast majority of people's lives. So I agree with you. There is a disconnect between the governed and the governing. But that's probably always true in one sense or another, that those who govern are responsive to democracy, but they're not delegates who are constantly a filter for everything that their electors are suggesting to them. So it's probably not that much different from how it has always been. The question is, as it's really pushed on people, do they accept it? Or do they say, well, actually, we don't agree with this, this is going too far? And I think the sex education issue has gone too far. But there are other things, such as gay marriage, where that wasn't a big issue until Parliament legislated for it. But though this may not be my view or the view of the Catholic Church or your view, actually the majority of people in the country are quite happy with it. And therefore that won't change. But I don't think this approach to sex education will survive meeting what the people want.
Yes, I think I have two responses to that. I try and keep them in mind so I don't lose either of them. I want to come to the sanctity of the human person and COVID in a moment. But just as a response to that, I agree with you. Most people don't seem to mind about gay marriage. They accept the argument, whatever heterosexuals can do, and heterosexuals have got up to all kinds of things in the last century. Why shouldn't same-sex attracted people do them as well? There's a sense of fair play, I think, at the heart of people's acceptance of that form of cultural variety. But the problem we have is that if it was only that, all would be well. But when Catholics and other Christians say, yes, but in terms of public policy and social glue, we actually have a preference and quite a strong preference for heterosexual marriage, and we've got reasons that are both doctrinaire and pragmatic for doing it, then we start to lose our jobs or find ourselves unemployable in the public space. And again, there's a disconnect between the influence of the extreme agencies that promote the ideologies and what the public wants. I don't think the public wants at all for teachers not to be able to get a job because they believe in marriage, or university lecturers, or doctors for that matter. But this disconnect, which I want to come to when we look at COVID in a moment, is really quite serious at this ethical level. And I think what worries me most of all is that, having acknowledged it's there, there doesn't seem to be any way of changing the trajectory again. There's no brake, no access to a steering wheel. It just seems to be getting worse. And therefore, although I like your attitude very much, and I think it's psychologically much healthier than mine, the sanguine attitude that we'll find some way of working out the disparity between government and popular opinion, at least in terms of the exclusion of people of belief from public office or public responsibility, that's getting worse, isn't it?
I wonder. I mean, the Kate Forbes thing, it will be interesting. And I think the reaction to her has been important in that, because it was thought impossible immediately her views were discovered for her to be elected. And then she's had a very respectable campaign. I think sometimes the people on our side go out of their way to be as difficult as possible, to make their argument in as unsympathetic a way as possible, and are then surprised when consequences follow. I don't think there's any need to be particularly aggressive about it, but I think it is important to stand up for what you believe in. I think governments have a very difficult line to tread. I'm very much in favour of policies that support the family. I think the family is the fundamental building block of society, as isn't a controversial view, at least in the purposes of this discussion, and that we have a series of policies that actually are very family unfriendly. And if you look at the latest proposal on childcare, the state will support you in childcare to have your children looked after by anybody that they don't know, but not by a member of the family who they do know. And this seems to me to be a very odd thing to do, an odd approach to looking after children. It would be better if you were supporting grandparents, uncles and aunts and so on, to be involved in childcare, the broader family to be involved. But that's not the way public policy is going. But the reason it's so difficult to promote the family is the tone in which we tried to do it in the 80s and early 90s. And this is very important, that what we want to be saying is that the family is a very good way for bringing up children, but that if for whatever reasons, if your life hasn't worked that way, you're bringing up a child by yourself, we're not trying to condemn you. And the language of the 80s and 90s was very condemnatory of people who weren't in a traditional family. And there's still a lot of that baggage to get rid of, I think. And as soon as you start talking about pro-family policies, who are you condemning? Well, you're not condemning anybody. You're just trying to help in a way that all the evidence shows is good for the children who are brought up within a family. And if we can get the language right, then we can get the policies right. But we have to recognize that because we didn't get the language right, there is a barrier that has to be broken through.
That's very interesting. I don't disagree with you. There's no question what you said is true. But I don't think it explains the whole thing. I, I suspect there's a psychological and perhaps also a spiritual reflex going on, that there is a common sense that right deep down, people know that the social and domestic anarchy that we live in is actually not a very good thing. And in terms of the balance of personal choice and family and public responsibility, we've got it wrong. And people don't want to be told off. They don't want to be reminded they're not doing it right, that they're failing some kind of internal moral barometer that they're half aware of and don't want to look at. So I think, although you're perfectly correct to say the language that the moral majority use has to be very gentle and kind rather than condemning, isn't it more than that? People really don't want to be told that they're living too hedonistically, and they're going to resent it. Whatever language you use, they're going to say, don't tell me how to live my life. I'll do what I please. Thank you.
Well, I also think there's a tension between the state and the family, that the family has always been the strongest counterpower to the state. And if you look at Scotland, it had that really sinister proposal that every child should have a nominated state individual who would be a sort of guardian to look after the child's interests and replace the parents. And the state always wants to do that because it is this competition between authorities. And therefore, politicians have to try and make sure that the family is promoted rather than the interests of the state. And you see this with the sex education issue that we were touching on earlier. They want to take that responsibility away from parents so that the state can tell people what is right and wrong. Now, I'm very suspicious of that. That's a bit too squeamish, really, to wish to give sex education to my children personally. So there's an element of me that's not altogether sorry the state is doing it. But it is about power and influence, and the state wants to have, particularly the left who believe in the collective, want to have the power of the state influencing children in a way that parents need to be very careful about.
I agree entirely. I think that the central issue at the moment that we're dealing with might be framed in a number of different ways: freedom of speech and censorship, freedom of choice and collective pressure. But one of the best ways is talking about the different ambitions of state and family. And of course, it gets difficult at this point because I don't want to upbraid you as a Conservative minister. That's not the purpose of this conversation.
Well, I'm not a minister anymore. So
that's true. But I mean, so a lot of people of faith who are not socialist by conviction, and there are honourable reasons for being socialist by conviction, but it comes with a belief in the state. And it's not just in Europe, but I mean, around the world in the last 50 years, the power of the state has grown inexorably, and technology has amplified that and acted as an unforeseen catalyst to it. Aren't the people who support the family, Catholics at the front of the queue, entitled to look at conservative parties in general, to avoid being a criticism of the Conservative Party in particular, and say, you're really not doing what we need to hold the power of the state at bay? So much more effort, energy, and above all, ideological conviction needs to be brought to bear to hold the state and the growth of technology back. But part of the problem is the only ideological conviction comes from Christianity, and that's thinner on the ground than it was. We're losing the ideological and the political battle, aren't we, to save the family?
Well, I think Ian Duncan Smith has done a lot of good work on this with think tank he set up after he ceased to be leader of the Conservative Party and the policies that he's been putting forward. Should we have done more? Yes, I think we should. I think we should look at how the tax and benefit system actually penalises families very, very sharply. You are financially much worse off being in a family than you are setting up your life as a pair of individuals. And that's unfortunate. That is something the Conservatives would have hoped could have done something about in 13 years, and we haven't. We think that the answer is always the state doling out more money rather than allowing families to keep more of their own money to start with. And so I think your criticism is a fair one. And I think, yes, of course. I mean, the whole of our society is based on Christian values, and people forget this, that there's the excellent book by Tom Holland, Dominion, which explains so many of the things that we take for granted, including a welfare state, grow out of Christianity and the concern that Christianity has to love thy neighbour. And that without this, we would have a very different, much more selfish society, but that there is a squeamishness about recognising the importance of Christianity in this.
Thank you. Yes. Well, I want to go to COVID. Were you surprised by the lockdowns? We're back again, I suppose. This is one of those occasions when what the state did and what people wanted were not too far apart, I was very surprised that people wanted to be locked down. But one of the things that Christianity, and Catholic Christianity in particular, brings is a great sense of the dignity of the individual. And this is part of the foundation upon which free speech is built, and without it, it disappears. I was immensely alarmed at the way in which our society seemed to jettison the freedom of the individual in the face of the state saying, well, this is so problematic medically that we're going to take unilateral action. And there are circumstances in what one can conceive that would have been not unreasonable, but those weren't them. And the people who wanted to engage in a scientific debate about what was really going on were shut down. We weren't able to have the debate. It turned out that we were right all along, that Sweden had fewer mortalities than anybody. You know the argument. Yeah. So without rehearsing those arguments in particular, the thing that alarmed me most of all was the way in which the state simply denuded its citizens of the kind of human rights that I think Christianity in particular, and maybe only Christianity, because of its sense of the sanctification of the individual, can provide. Wasn't that an ideological crisis at root?
Well, it was absolutely outrageous that the state banned the sacraments for a period.
Absolutely.
That was not the business of the state. It shouldn't have done it. The idea that you could ban baptism was monstrous. And I hope that anybody who needed a baptism ignored the law, that it was not a valid law, to my mind, and that there are some things that the state simply cannot do. And the churches made a mistake in going along with the first shutdown. We got much more robust by the second shutdown, and there was a period when churches were able to open for private prayer. And this was rather wonderful, because there's a church that I go to sometimes that was able to carry out the extraordinary form of the Mass, which is, of course, silent prayer. And people could be there with their own silent prayer and able to fulfill their Sunday obligation in a very satisfactory way. And as the time went on, more and more people realized this was happening and were able to go to Mass. And it's one of the virtues of the extraordinary form. But I think with the first lockdown, everybody went along with it, really. The churches, the state, everybody. I think it was later, it was into the summer, that people realized that this was a mistake. But what we realize from the release of Matt Hancock's documents is that there was a part of the state that was trying to manipulate us all to ensure that we remained locked down. And not just the general public, but the Prime Minister.
Yeah.
And they were trying to manipulate him to terrify him into agreeing to a lockdown, which they succeeded in doing, which was against his natural instinct. And I think that's much worse, actually, that the state was not acting rationally, looking through the scientific advice. It decided on a policy and then looked for the evidence to back the policy. So it was not evidence-based policymaking, but policy-based evidence searching.
I took your point earlier on that it's better for the Catholic Church not to over-identify with the establishment. But given the experience of COVID and the way in which the state moved in some of those outrageous forms, and something that you and I would both recognize philosophically, that the lure of power is so profound that it's never any surprise when politicians, being given the opportunity to exercise unlimited power, do exercise it and inevitably exercise it badly. That's part of a Christian worldview of humanity. We expect, we're not surprised by it. We just tried to limit its capacity to function. And the surprise was it wasn't limited. Every so often, I wonder if the only solution is a form of a Christian democratic party, one where Christians get together politically and say, well, we can't find ourselves represented within the old system. It hasn't worked very well in Europe. There's no model I can see that's particularly inspirational to do it like this. But there seems to me to be a gap between the fact that Christianity isn't represented within the present political systems, it's actually rather disdained and rejected, and the fact that Christians don't have any, they wouldn't have much leverage, whether it's the abortion clinics having our views on marriage simply allowed to be part of the liberal establishment, whether it's our passionate conviction that every human being is sacred. The opportunities to express this politically and culturally seem to me to be diminishing. I think you look more sanguine than I am, but do you have any response to this sense of a gap developing between Christian conscience, Christian witness in our secular society and the direction of the political process?
Well, I think the separation of church and state is actually very important for the church. If you look at the periods of history when the church tried to become too involved in politics, it tended not to be very successful for the church, that it distracted it from its fundamental task, and it didn't have the ruthlessness of a secular state to achieve its ends as a secular state anyway. And to some extent, it undermines the magisterium that if the church is dealing in truth, there is no truth in economic policy. There just isn't. And if you pretend there is, then when you are saying the truth about transubstantiation or whatever it happens to be, people say, well, if you're wrong on this, then you'd be wrong on that too. So it fundamentally undermines authority in the church. So I think the separation is important and beneficial. And I wouldn't want to try and establish a new political party. I think if you look at the European Christian Democrat parties, a lot of them are now neither Christian nor particularly democratic. So I wouldn't try and go down that route again. But I think those of us in the business of politics have to remember that those who are in the church are doing something that is fundamentally greater and more important. And that is about the next life rather than this life. But that I can't confuse the two. I am not in the business of saving souls. I am in the business of trying to work out how this country can be governed better, whilst at the same time hoping not to do things that are actively evil. The church is there to save souls by setting us a standard that none of us manage to live up to, and then forgiving us when we fail and forgiving us again when we fail again. And that's very, very different. And I wouldn't try and confuse the two, but equally, it is very important that people like me in politics maintain the right of those who are in the religious sphere to express their views clearly and defend their right to speak out and support them when they are saying things that are touch on the political sphere.
Yes, thank you. I think that's a plea that important to know that it's heard politically. Let me finish by asking you, I hope in a way that you can answer. If you were a cardinal and you were preparing for the conclave of a new pope, what kind of pope would you be looking or hoping for?
Well, that's great. I mean, if anyone wants to make me a cardinal, I'd be delighted. I'd be the first lay cardinal for some time, but I've always thought that would be a very nice position to have, but I think unlikely in the modern world. What would I like to see? Well, I don't know whether it isn't an impertinence for me to say, as this is really a matter for the Holy Ghost, who will give us the Pope that we deserve and need. And sometimes it's more deserve and sometimes it's more need,
Quite, quite.
depending on the feelings of the Holy Ghost.
We understand.
I think it is overwhelmingly important that the next pope does not try to be part of the secular world. I don't think there is a route that allows Catholicism to be acceptable to the secular world without turning it into pap. And then there's no point. Then we give up. It was very damaging to the Anglican Church when the Bishop of Durham said that he didn't really believe in the resurrection. We cannot have a pope, and I think it's inconceivable, we would have a pope who doesn't believe in the resurrection and therefore everything that flows from that, and that the pope, the Holy Father, is the custodian of truth. And that means not changing truth to meet current political mores and fashions. That's the risk that they feel under pressure, the new pope will feel under pressure to boost numbers by taking on views that go against the historic teaching of the church. And it won't work. That actually, it's really interesting that the Catholic Church is at its strongest, whereas it's most rigorous. And you see this to some degree in the devotion to the extraordinary form, that the congregations going to that are young and are enthusiastic and are well educated in the teaching of the church. The people going to the guitar fests are people who were young in the 1960s and thought that would draw people in, and it didn't. Pap does not work, and therefore I should like a pope, and actually very much in the Pope Benedict mold, who is completely clear about the truth that he is the custodian of.
all kinds of ways I'd like to develop that, but we probably taxed our listeners' patience. Jacob Rees-Mogg, thank you so much for spending the time having with this conversation. It's been a real delight to talk to you, and we're very grateful. Thank you.
It's been my pleasure and honour. Thank you. Thank you very much.